People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Today, a very large proportion of families can't afford to pay market prices for housing. Low-income renters are the hardest hit. But a short supply of affordable housing and slow growth in both jobs and incomes has made it increasingly challenging for young, middle-income families to buy their first homes. Inclusionary housing, also known as inclusionary zoning, is one of the major policy tools used to address this crisis. These programs require or encourage market-rate housing developments to include a percentage of homes affordable to low and moderate income households. Generally, it's between 10 and 20%, and often these units are scattered throughout the development. Inclusionary housing has created over 34,000 affordable homes and apartments in California over the past 30 years, but it is controversial for reasons that we'll discuss today. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing. My guest today is Diane J. Spaulding, Executive Director of the Nonprofit Housing Association of Northern California, better known as NPH. Since 1979, NPH has been the collective voice of those who support, build, and finance affordable housing. So welcome, Diane. It's good to meet
you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
How do you do this, Diane? How do you actually support affordable housing as an organization?
Well, we're going to be 30 years old next year. We're up to 750 members, of which about 60 are actual nonprofit housing development corporations like Eden Housing. And we support their work by basically creating the most favorable environment for the development of affordable housing that you can possibly, you know, create. We do that through training. We do that through an annual conference. We do it through public policy and advocacy. We hone in on strategies like inclusionary housing because they can boost affordable housing production. We're eyes and ears in places like Washington, D.C. and in Sacramento. The developers can't afford to have lobbyists on their staff full time, so we act as their eyes and ears to look at legislation and make sure that nothing bad gets enacted that will create barriers to development, and at the same time, we proactively look for solutions to the affordable housing crisis.
Primarily on the state level, is that where you're
you know, we work at the local, regional, state, and federal level. At the local level, we have seated a capacity in the nine Bay Area counties where we support the activities of local either housing action coalitions or housing advocacy groups. At the regional level, we will focus on entities like the Association of Bay Area Governments or the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, or working in partnership with groups like the Bay Area Council. We create alliances, once again, that kind of elevate the issue of affordable housing, workforce housing, housing for working families, and try to, you know, really create alliances that foster more development. There's no question that in the last decade, though, we have definitely focused more of our efforts at the state level and have seen some pretty significant achievements there.
So you're an independent organization. You're not a chapter of a
national
group. No,
we are affiliated with a few groups, but I think it's safe to say that it's probably not an accident that the San Francisco Bay Area is one of the shining examples in the entire country of where you've seen a proliferation of this third sector, meaning the nonprofit sector, producing dramatic amounts of affordable housing. We're probably much, unparalleled, maybe Boston, maybe the supportive housing network in New York, where there's a lot of, you know, homelessness. San Francisco Bay Area, we have a lot of talent. We've produced, actually, our developers in the last 30 years have produced over 70,000 units of affordable housing. And the fact that NPH happens to be co-located at this, you know, I think it's pretty clear that when you have a an interest in aligning yourselves, in joining together as a movement, as an industry, as a sector. You agree that you're going to kind of fight for a cause, which is affordable housing, that you can get pretty dramatic results. So no, we're a 501c3. We do have alliances with, there's a group in Washington, D.C. called the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, a group called the National Housing Conference here in California. We have two statewide housing coalitions. One is Housing California, focused on housing for extremely low-income, very low-income people. There's a larger umbrella group called the California Housing Corporation that focuses on housing really for middle-income workforce, housing for first-time home buyers, and so we work with both of those groups in collaboration.
Today we want to focus on very specifically inclusionary housing. What works, what doesn't, what needs to change in order to increase the supply of affordable housing. For openers, can you provide a bit of history or just a brief history on how inclusionary housing came into being?
Well, it started in the East Coast in a place called Montgomery County, Virginia. Migrated west. We in California, the very first inclusionary housing policy was enacted in 1973 in the city of Palo Alto. So once again, we're kind of back to the Bay Area being one of those very avant-garde places where new innovative approaches are tried. In 1973 to basically the early 90s, we saw about 65 inclusionary housing policies adopted in the region. We did our study 5 years ago looking at the last 30 years of inclusionary housing. And just in that time frame, in from the early 90s to 2004, we were up to over 170 communities in the state that have inclusionary now. 3 years later, we're up to over 190. When you think that California has 470, roughly 465 cities, when you're up to 190, that's a pretty significant amount of jurisdictions that have embraced this policy. And it is, I believe, you know, the train has left the station and more communities are adopting some form of inclusionary housing because it works and it produces much needed workforce housing.
Is it a matter of developers won't do this unless they're forced to?
Well, there's no question that we did in our report, we surveyed characteristics of inclusionary housing policies, and we tried to hone in on what characteristics make for the most successful policies. There's no question that mandatory policies work better than voluntary policies. So we favor the mandate. It works and it produces more housing. We also look at things like what percentage of income they're going to be targeting in terms of trying to build housing. Once again, unless you really deeply target these programs, the tendency is to move towards higher income housing because it's easier to build. We have kind of embraced an approach where one size does not fit all. So every community in California, all of these 190 plus cities actually have different inclusionary housing policies. It might be counterintuitive to think that's a good thing, like it's kind of wacky, but actually it is a good thing because it means that every local community designed their own policy within local context and their own local housing needs. So you'll find places where 10% is required. You'll find other places where 25 or 30% is required to be inclusionary. The average is 15%. You'll find communities that focus on home ownership. You find communities that really want to try to build rental housing. It all depends upon the local context, and we think that's a really good idea.
Is there tremendous pushback from the development community?
There sure can be. absolutely.
Not only when the laws are being designed and implemented, then once they start actually working. I mean, I'm sure there are loopholes and ways
there
of getting around it.
Well, the key we think is flexibility. As long as you have flexibility and you have a range of choices, then that tends to help with the opposition. There is a perception that the burden of an inclusionary housing policy is borne by the developer. And the reality is that inclusionary housing policies are, it's local governments in partnership with developers that build inclusionary housing.
Which means what? Give me an example.
Which means, we can use Eden Housing as an example. I mean, Eden has very successfully partnered with many for-profit developers. Usually what happens is they'll be in a community that has inclusionary housing, and a development opportunity will come up, and a city council will like to see the best possible package they can in terms of the development that's going to be built. And the most successful have been these joint ventures where a for-profit developer would like to build market-rate housing. Let's say the inclusionary housing policy is 15%, and Eden Housing will come in. They'll partner with that for-profit developer. Sometimes it will be a land donation. The for-profit developer may have a parcel of land in close proximity to where the market rate development is going to be going in. They will donate that land to Eden Housing, and then Eden Housing will be able to build beautiful, contemporary, affordable housing. Sometimes it's integrated within one complex. That is not, once again, we favor flexibility because one size doesn't fit all. And you oftentimes, by being flexible, you get more affordable housing built. So that's really kind of the approach.
Where does the controversy lie?
The controversy lies around who's paying for it. The for-profit developer, they are, clearly, the burden is being borne somewhere. And so the real question is that burden so great that it's going to inhibit development? Obviously, because there's been a proliferation of these policies over the last, 10, 20, 30 years. And obviously because we're seeing thousands and thousands of units being built at affordable levels, we do not believe that this policy impedes, development.
What's not working about inclusionary housing policy?
Well, we actually think inclusionary housing policies are working. I think there is somewhat of a perception that in down economic times, inclusionary housing is not a good policy. There really is no evidence to support that. And in fact, if you look at what happens in down economic cycles, and obviously we're in a particularly acute housing crisis nationally right now, it's actually an opportunity. If a local government does not have an inclusionary housing in place, they can't, land costs go down when there's an economic down cycle, development opportunities arise. And so if cities are really being proactive and they're really being aggressive, they can, land values drop, you can buy land, you can bank that land.
So you think it's even a better environment?
Well, oftentimes it is, because you can get the land cheaper, you can hold on to the land, and then you have this policy in place, and then whomp, the minute the cycle turns, which it inevitably will. Housing is one of those, housing cycles come and go, and we will see an economic upturn. The housing market will rebound, and then you are ready. The prime is pumped, and you are ready to start building again. We know from our work around not just inclusionary housing, but when you look at cities' general plans, they are required to create something called a housing element. We actually happen to be in a brand new housing element cycle in the Bay Area right now, just started on July 1st. Every city, 110 cities in the 9 Bay Area counties, must over the next year update their housing element. That means they have to look at their land inventory. They have to look at all the policies that they have in place. They have to look at zoning, and they have to create a plan that ensures that there will be enough housing for their resident population. And so it's a perfect time, to look at inclusionary housing and look at other approaches so that you're ready. And we've looked at housing elements over really a 10-year period. There's no question that if you don't have a housing element ready, if you don't have a certified housing element, which is required by the state of California, that if you don't have a housing element, which is a planning tool, inclusionary housing is an actual production tool. If you don't, plan to build housing, you will fail to build housing. Same with inclusionary housing. If you have an inclusionary housing program in place, you will build more affordable housing. It happens. They are connected. So you don't just need to plan. You have to have land. You have to have planning. You have to have policies. You have to have money. And
so is what I'm hearing that the best inclusionary housing policies are those with the most flexibility?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And paying attention to opportunity. So don't this rigidity about, the housing must be on site, or, that the housing must be identical, must look exactly the same.
One size does not fit all.
One size does not fit all. And so being flexible about design, being flexible about location, being flexible about where the housing is located, being smart about where the housing is located. So certainly looking for transit-oriented development opportunities, looking for places to locate the housing near BART, near bus line, near amenities like stores. I mean, we certainly don't support sprawl development or anything like that. And in fact, affordable housing developers have been doing, Eden, once again, is a wonderful example, turning 40 years old. They've been building smart, affordable housing for 40 years, long before sustainable development or smart growth or any of the current, terms that we use to describe the kind of change in development landscape in California.
But it's really about partnerships. It's about partnerships between nonprofit and for-profit, between cities and developers and all of these various entities, and you as an organization support all of that.
It takes a village, it may sound a little corny, but it takes a lot of partners to successfully build affordable housing that is sustained over the long term.
And you're confident that much more will be built
absolutely,
in the coming years?
Absolutely. Based on the track record in the Bay Area, we have the talent, we have the sophistication, we have the capacity, we have it all.
Excellent. Diane, thanks so much for being on the Affordable Housing Podcast today.
You're welcome.
Diane Spaulding is Executive Director of the Nonprofit Housing Association of Northern California. I'm Joanne Green.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.